We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from five-star app Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host today, Ariel Garten. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation and mindfulness practices have the power to change our lives. You can check out the Meditation Studio app in the App Store, where you'll find over 500 meditations on everything from sleep, stress, and anxiety to happiness, motivation, confidence, and so much more, all designed to inspire you to solve the big and little challenges we face in life and to be your best self every day. It's like having a little inspirational coach in your pocket. And we just launched two beautiful new sleep collections with music for you and your kiddos. Check it out. Today, join Muse co-founder, neuroscientist, brainiac, and Untangle co-host, Ariel Garten, as she goes inside the head of her amazing guests. Thanks, Patricia.
Hello, I'm Ariel, and I'll be your guide as we go inside the head of some of the world's most extraordinary brain scientists, psychologists, meditators, those who are skilled in the mental arts. And we're going to learn both from their cutting-edge work and their own human experience, how our brains work, how to optimize them, and how to manage the crazy in all of our minds.
This week, we're going to get inside the head of the amazing Dr. Jeffrey Martin. Dr. Jeffrey Martin has conducted what's probably the largest social science experiment on fundamental well-being. He has gone and identified thousands of people who have actually brought themselves into a state of persistent fundamental well-being, and then he's gone and created a methodology that can potentially help you get there. Dr. Martin is a scientist, he's a sociologist, he's one of the founders of the transformational technology movement. He creates courses at Stanford and Sophia University, and he's here with us today. Welcome, Jeff, and thanks for letting us inside your head.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you. And a fan of Muse, we should say. We're all so grateful in the transformative technology movement for what you've done. You have been one of the pillars that really enabled that space to be created worldwide. And so, you know, I don't know if people ever say that back to you on your podcast, but I'm definitely going to, because, you know, we're just so grateful.
It's very, 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 very kind. Thank you. Well, I'm also grateful to you. I've actually been taking the Finders course. I'm midway through. And so I've experienced some of the transitions that you have described in your book and that you have sort of brought together in your methodology. So let's start off by just describing what is fundamental well-being.
Absolutely. So fundamental well-being is what has been traditionally thought of as the heart of enlightenment or non-duality or persistent mystical experience, unitive consciousness, all these religious and spiritual terms that we actually totally respect. And, you know, we think it's fantastic that religious and spiritual systems have been a carrier of knowledge of this state over really millennia, the rise and fall of empires. But as you know, I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, and so I approach things not from the lens of religion and spirituality, but from the lens of our own human nervous system and what we can do from that standpoint. So I think it's always important to note that there are so many atheists and agnostics that also are in our research data. This really does seem to be just a core change that can occur in the human nervous system. And it's at its heart, it's really a change away from what made a lot of sense back in the day, you know, before humans were at the top of the food chain, when we really had a lot of threats and we were under threat at all times. We as a species have the same fundamental discontentment that other animals have. And that fundamental discontentment serves animals very, very well because, you know, it's okay if you have a little food, but you still need to look around for what's going to eat you. Now, we don't have that issue anymore, right? Because we're living relatively safe lives. That's not to say if you're living in a tribe in the Brazilian rainforest that this still isn't a very functional piece of human neuroanatomy, because most likely it is. You're not at the top of the food chain entirely in a situation like that. But, you know, I'm sitting in Palo Alto, California, where we don't even bother to lock our doors for the most part. I mean, it's just so safe, you know. I don't worry about anybody bursting in during this interview and harming me in any way or anything like that. I'm not going to starve trying to make it to the next berry bush or, you know, wonder where my next meal is going to come from. I'm trying to resist chocolate bars and, you know, not balloon up to be 300 pounds and stuff like that, right? And so there's been this fundamental shift that can occur in our human psychology away from sort of what we might think of as more of that traditional nature that served humanity so well for tens of thousands of years and longer, and towards a feeling that everything is okay. Because really, everything pretty much is okay in our modern Western lives today. And so at its heart, fundamental well-being involves that shift at a very deep baseline level of psychology. And once you have that shift, boy, everything just completely changes in terms of your experience of life. You know, instead of your foundational world being based on fear and worry and anxiety and stuff like that, it's instead based on, you know, a sense that everything is okay, that you don't really need to add anything to yourself, that you're fine the way you are. There's just a degree of comfort and ease with life. It seems to genuinely be, and I think of it as, a modern upgrade for our nervous system that nature is very slowly rolling out over the last few thousand years.
You know, as I went through my own journey of letting go of my fears, I recognized that even until extremely recently, even with a deep meditation practice, I would still lie awake in my Toronto house, in an incredibly safe neighborhood, an incredibly safe place. And in the back of my mind, there was still a story that a man in black was going to crawl through the window and do harm to me. And particularly as a small female, these things are just so deeply ingrained. And when I really queried it, I realized that the image in my head was from a movie that I had seen on an airplane when I was somewhere between 10 and 15 years old. And it stuck with me, and it taught my nervous system that I needed to be afraid in times when I really didn't. And it just left this fundamental imprint of unsafety, of dis-ease inside of me. And that's one of probably thousands of instances of imprints of things that my body is afraid of, or was afraid of, and completely doesn't need to be, because they're just fictions.
Exactly. And it all relates to that underlying neural mechanism, you know, just sort of the way our brain is wired, literally the way our brain is wired, because what changes is networks in the brain with a transition to fundamental well-being. And so there's literally just a rewiring that happens in the brain from sort of that old way to kind of an upgraded way. And so that circuitry is there to layer onto, and it doesn't just sit there dormantly, as you experienced. You know, if your spouse comes home and is like, I'm leaving you, or your boss says you're fired, or whatever else, it feels like a tiger is ripping your arm off. It can literally feel like your life is in jeopardy, right? Which is kind of crazy, because there's billions of people in the world that are potential partners. There's no shortage of opportunity in the West, economic opportunity and otherwise. And yet these things, these stories that we've built up, these conditioned fears, they lay over on top of that neural system. That neural system is constantly looking for new stories and new things that it can put, that it can basically match up to and drive us with and whatnot. And so it's brutal, because there's really nothing that can be done about that in any sort of deep, meaningful way. You can kind of patch it a little bit. You can use self-help stuff, positive psychology stuff, You know, you can increase well-being, but you can never really get rid of that fundamental discontentment. It's just because of the way we're wired without shifting the wiring.
So you suggested that there are people who have been able to shift their wiring and who have been able to find fundamental contentment. Tell us about them.
Absolutely.
And tell us about how you got there, because you went on a fascinating research project.
I totally did. About probably 15 years ago now, I had had a very successful run across media and technology and business and whatever else. And I really could have just, you know, gone and sat on a porch or traveled around the world, done exotic things or whatever else for the rest of my life if I wanted to. Of course, I didn't do that. I was working my butt off running companies. Because that's what you do. You tend to keep doing the same thing, right? But it just dawned on me, like, you know, I'm not unhappy, but I do have that fun. I did constantly notice that fundamental sense of discontentment. And so I really just thought to myself, you know, if I keep doing this, I'm probably going to keep getting the same result psychologically. And so I just decided to make a massive life change. I sold the companies and all of that. I went back to school and picked up training. At that time, I had graduate degrees in business and computing type stuff. And I went back and picked up psychology and neuroscience, cognitive science, transformation, the study of how people change, which is really what I did my PhD in this specific area. It's kind of amazing what's happened since then, because I got the training I needed, I felt, to really try to ask the question, who are the happiest people on earth and how can I become one of them? It was a totally selfish quest, right? I mean, there was nothing in this about I'm going to change the world and make people happier or whatever. It was just for me. Well, I got out and I started looking across these various populations and I wound up encountering one, which are spiritual people, you know, people that are religious, people that make these fantastic claims about how they're experiencing the world. And be honest, I thought, you know, this is going to be psychopathology. I'm going to find a lot of self-deception. And I just could not find it. I could not find psychopathology in this population. It really seemed like it was what it was. What we were really doing initially was asking people cognitive science-based questions because I was trying to sort them for neuroscience. So I was trying to sort them for fMRI and EEG work to really measure their brains and to see what was different in their brains. And those are very hard, as you well know from all of your EEG work. You know, people often think, oh, you just get people in, you measure their brains, and then there's some magic software that tells you, you know, what's different. But it's hard. You know, you spent years perfecting the MUSA software, which is hands down, you know, like so far beyond everything else out there. But that's not an accident. You know, there was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that had to go into your creation of that.
Yeah, it was 10 years of solving one problem, one very singular question. Can we look at focused attention versus mind wandering? That's it. And it took probably 10 years.
And that's the way these neuroscience projects go. People don't realize that, but the average new area of neuroscience that gets looked into, and this was definitely a new area, it takes 5 to 7 years to do the legwork before you ever get anybody into a scanner. So what we did in order to prepare for that was ask people cognitive science-based questions because we needed to sort things along the lines of regions in the brain and networks in the brain and stuff like that. And so you do that from sort of a cognitive neuroscience standpoint. And you do that by asking people cognitive questions and trying to get your arms around stuff. One strange and totally unexpected byproduct of that was that by asking people about thoughts, emotions, memories, sense of self, their perception, we completely sidestepped God, spaciousness, the void, you know, all the stuff that people normally talk about in relation to this. And just sort of by accidentally asking these questions to sort people for neuroscience scanning, we wound up being able to construct this map at a cognitive level across all of these people and really finding the common core of these experiences beneath culture, beneath their programming, worldwide. And so that alone was really revolutionary. And as I just came out with a book. It's been 10 years in the making. So I wound up writing this book in 2010 and then refining it. And so this book just came out. But I have to say, already from all around the world, I've heard from so many people who are like, oh my God, you're like the first person to actually write about my interior experience. I thought I was the only one. I've heard that for many years from our paper on our main scholarly website, nonsymbolic.org. And so I know that those categories hold up, and I know that they hold up worldwide, not just from the research, but from random people. And they're very helpful. It's helpful to know where you are, and it's helpful to know that you're not alone. It's helpful to know sort of how to deal with this major life change.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you've ever thought about therapy and haven't quite jumped in yet, it may be the right time to explore BetterHelp. Whether you're looking for new coping skills or to improve a relationship, or maybe dealing with some social anxiety or just need to recharge your batteries so you can be the best version of yourself, therapy is great, and this could be just the right time to give BetterHelp a shot. Finding a therapist through BetterHelp is easy. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and they do their best to match you with a licensed therapist that's a great fit for you. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now back to our show.
So for people who may or may not have found persistent fundamental well-being, can you talk a little bit about what the characteristics of it are? What is it like? I know in your book, you go into different levels, level one, level two. Walk us through some of these characteristics on the different levels.
So we use locations, not levels. And part of that is a political decision on our part, just not to make something better than another thing. So one thing to think about as we go through this is that rather than thinking of these as progressive levels that someone should want to attain, I think it's really helpful to think of them as which one of these most matches my current life with each one of these locations. So we can walk through them real quick. So location one has that fundamental change, and they all experience it across the entire continuum, but that fundamental change is the thing I most look for at location one. Somebody basically saying, geez, you know, I used to have this fundamental sense that something just wasn't quite right all the time. And I had all these goals, and my mind was trying to tell me, you know, well, if you just get this car, or if you just get this partner, or if you just get X, Y, or Z, then that'll make this thing, this sort of fundamental sense of discontent will go away. Everything will finally be okay if you just do that, right? And of course, all of us have lived our lives getting an endless string of those things. You know, some goals we fail at, some goals we succeed at. And every time we succeed at a goal, we might get a little relief for a little while, but then that fundamental sense of discontentment comes back in. And so that change to things seeming fundamentally okay, the sense of completeness, wholeness, or other ways of thinking about it. In location one, people also often feel larger than their bodies, as an example, like they tend to be more connected than they've experienced before that. They'll have a reduction in how quickly, basically, their negative emotions fall off. And so they'll have, you know, when a negative emotion hits and when a negative emotion occurs, it'll fall off more rapidly. I like to use the example that so many research subjects use with me, which is that if you get cut off in traffic, you know, you're no longer tailgating the person for blocks and, you know, whatever else, right? You know, it doesn't produce the same degree of sustained anger. It's not to say you don't flip them off, or, you know, have some choice words for them for a moment, but then, you know, you're right back sort of to peace after that, or, it, you know, these things just sort of extinguish. So that's a big change. The reduction in self-referential thinking, which is that sort of voice in your head. And so that really loses its power, loses its emotional saliency at worst. And at best, it quiets down. People will often say, all of my thoughts went away. Which was, when I was first starting the research, I was like, that's an astonishing way of putting that. What do they mean, all of my thoughts have gone away? And what I since realized is that the vast majority of the thoughts rolling through our head every day are self-referential thoughts. And so what they were really, you know, what they were really experiencing internally was this dramatic reduction in self-referential thoughts. And it kind of made their mind feel empty once those were gone, or once they weren't as salient and sort of pulling them into those thought streams and stuff. So that's a good sort of thumbnail around location one type stuff. You experience sort of that fundamental contentment and peace and stuff, but it's very in the background in location one. There's a lot of, you know, still have positive and negative emotions, can still be triggered by the people around you. You still got a lot of psychological conditioning and whatnot, but it's a much, much better way to experience the world. You know, when you make it to location one, you are the luckiest person on the face of the earth. You're just so fortunate to have gotten to that place. So location two, it's a continuum. And so a lot of things just sort of continue to progress. So self-referential thinking falls off even more. Negative emotions fall off even more towards the deepest parts of location two. Your emotion is really just mostly positive all of the time. There's one big characteristic that comes in with location two, and that is there's a form of non-duality, which if your folks listening to the podcast and watching this have, you know, meditated for a long time, I'm sure they've run across the word non-duality. But just to define it a little bit, it's kind of like it's that sense that everything, there's just sort of one thing. That's the easiest way to describe it. And when I'm trying to just sort of quickly determine whether or not somebody experiences it, I usually ask them a couple of questions. And so one question that I'll ask them is, when you look out at the world, when you look at me, whatever you're looking at, when you look out at the world, does it seem like there's something inside here that is looking out? Does it seem like there's a looker? Yeah, there's a me of some form that's literally feels like it's looking out. And so I experienced that for most of my life. When I talked to the research subjects and stuff for the early parts of the research, they would describe that other version of looking. And I would be like, okay, I don't experience that version. There's a me looking out, right? So there's a very clear and distinct sense. And the other way to view it is, or is everything just sort of showing up? You know, when you open your eyes, is everything just sort of showing up? It doesn't really feel like there's a me looking out. It's just like everything is just sort of there. And if you feel like everything is just sort of there, there's two ways that that can show up. One is it can be sort of everything is there, but it's just sort of out there, sort of like a like you'd see sort of projected on a movie screen in a way, but I'm still here. So I'm opening up my eyes and everything is just showing up. There isn't a me looking out necessarily, but there is still a distinction between I'm here and then there's everything out there that's showing up. And then there's a third category, which is when I open my eyes, everything is just showing up, including me, like I'm part of the thing that's just showing up. And so the latter two are different types of non-dual experience, and there are in fact many different types.
This is fascinating as you describe it. I've gone partway through the Finder's course, which we'll get to in a bit, which is you are taking a set of methodologies and applying it to finding fundamental well-being. And as you describe this experience of looking at, I'm testing it myself. So had you asked me prior to doing your Finder's course with all the range of meditation and positive psychology exercises in it, I would have definitely answered that there was a me looking at, no question. As I sat here doing this test, I recognized that there is a world around me with stuff in it, and I was a part of it, and I am existing within it. So I wouldn't put myself all the way towards complete non-dual experience, but I definitely have the sense that the world around me and me, we are all contents of the same thing. We are all, pieces in the same bucket.
Exactly. And that is a form of non-duality. That's a totally valid form of location two style, location two type non-duality. Another perceptual, some people are not as aware visually. And so auditorily, this can be done as well. So you can ask yourself, is there a listener? Or does it feel like it's just showing up? Like there's, just, you know, like the sounds are sort of just showing up, like they're just there. And so you have sort of these different sensory ways to sort of analyze depth of non-duality, degree of penetration of non-duality, and stuff like that. But that is the big change that occurs with location two, is a transition into this other way of perception, this other way of sort of perceiving things that you're now experiencing, which is, you know, fantastic.
And then I actually hadn't identified that a shift had taken place. I think I've always been a little bit level one, which is probably why I've gotten into the world of meditation so deeply, and always wanted to share it with other people and create things to help other people get to the state that I felt like I was in, a relatively low inner critic, a general feeling of calm. You know, people would always say that I was tune happy. Ironically, I have a happiness gene that only 5% of the population has. So yeah, there was always something about me that was positive and joyful. So location one sort of I identified with. As I was reading the book, location two I did not yet identify with. But it was fascinating to do that experiment and recognize that I've actually, through doing the exercises you recommended, taken on some of those qualities and not realized it.
And it's exactly what you're saying. You know, it's how you walk people through sort of these types of examples and steps, this is really easy to miss. And that's a fascinating thing, I think, because people are like, wait a minute, you're telling me that enlightenment can be missed or non-duality can be missed or whatever. How is that possible? It's kind of incredible that, you know, you can have these amazing transitions, this whole other way of being, and not realize it right away. But that totally happens to people, even to people who are so completely immersed in it. One of the main reasons for that, I think, is because self-reflection reduces so significantly with it. And so you're not going through sort of those self-analytical processes like the ordinary person does. And as a result of that, you're not analyzing yourself like you did before. You're not analyzing things in your head like you did before. And you just miss it until something probes you. And then you're like, oh, hey, wait a minute.
Until you listen to a podcast and somebody says, look out at the world around you. How do you perceive right. it? Right. It's probably right. people listening to this right now saying, have I been in fundamental well-being this whole time? And actually, exactly. that's why you wrote the book, to allow people to discover different states of fundamental well-being, to identify themselves in the book, or if they don't identify right. themselves, to offer a roadmap for how to get there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so location three, just to finish your question, location three is very different than the places that come before it, but you can also see the obvious progression. It's a further reduction in self-referential thought, and all of that type of stuff. But emotion life changes considerably. And basically, there is just one dominant emotion that feels like a combination of three different things. One is love, one is compassion, and one is joy. You know, you're experiencing this all the time, and it's a dispersonal form of it. And so it takes two different forms. Some people feel it from a divine standpoint, though, so to feel like divine love, for instance. Other people don't get the divine version of it. They get feeling like everything is conscious, or feeling like everything has a consciousness or something like that. And so if you think about the end of the Christian mystical path, this is their location, basically, on the continuum, or the Abrahamic traditions in general, Sufis in Islam or whatever, Kabbalists even from Judaism. And so there's this sense of union with the divine that Christians, for instance, talk about. Their success in their own mystical path is finally getting to this place where they feel like there's this union with the divine, and this increasing sort of merging with it as they deepen in to their own mystical path. That is really location three in a nutshell, except that not everybody gets the divine version of it. You can also just get the sense that everything is conscious, that that's what you're merging into, so this bigger consciousness. So location four brings a very different experience of this. And it's really a sense where you lose agency, you lose the sense that you can do anything or make a decision, which sounds terrifying to the average person. You know, you still have agency through the first three locations, but by the time you're in, there's some things in location two where people say, well, there's no doer anymore and stuff like that, right? What they're talking about is a fundamental change in their sense of self, where it feels like sort of who they were has kind of gone away, but they still have agency, right? If you say, you know, can you raise your hand for me right now? They'd say, sure, I can raise my hand, you know, for you right now. Or if you say to a location four person, can you raise your hand right now? They'll say something like, well, my hand can be raised, but it's not me doing it. It's not, you know, they have a whole other level of that not me-ness than the location two people have for their not me-ness. There's a synchronistic sense that comes, you know, it feels like when you don't have a sense of agency, it just feels like everything is kind of magically unfolding. So the word that is most associated with location four is freedom. There is so much more freedom that you experience than in the rest of the continuum, which of course is a night and day difference than normal waking reality for ordinary people. And what that really comes from is a release of needing other people's approval. Hmm. And when you don't need, even don't have a sense
of that sounds so good. Level,
yeah, it's just like, a freedom on a level that is unimaginable. And so the well-being is much higher in location four than it is even in location three, which is higher than location two, which is higher than location one. But one of the things that you can hear, and we could talk about location five and six and so on, but most people are going to land in locations one through four. When you just listen to these locations one through four, you can identify that like some of them are going to be better for some things than others, right?
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
So you've taken these findings on meeting hundreds of people who found fundamental well-being, and you said, how can I design a course or curriculum that's going to help the average, everyday, ordinary person find this fundamental well-being? Can you talk a little bit, A, about the process of doing that, and B, what you created at the end?
Yeah, sure. So what we actually created was an experiment. How are we going to get AB data? We need to know who someone was before, what changed during, and who they became after. How are we going to get there? We have to get there. It's the next logical step in the research. Well, we'd asked the question that I'd ignored, actually, on our intake forms. And so, you know, you ask people, what's your background? You know, what's your religious and spiritual background? What practices have you done? All kinds of stuff on background forms. And there was a question on there that asked, what worked for you? Now, you would have thought that we would have just ran right to that answer, you know, right when we were collecting the data and stuff, that it wouldn't have been something that we ignored for years. So I didn't basically believe what they put on that line. I didn't want to believe what they put on that line because I knew that they had this proclivity to like transition to fundamental well-being and then think that they knew how to teach other people to get there. And I figured they were probably putting like their own methods or something on that line or, you know, whatever else. It just seemed like that was going to be a biased answer that I shouldn't waste research time on. But at the end of the day, at that moment in time, all we had was that line on those surveys. And so we went back and we analyzed it. And to my surprise, there were a handful of things that actually rose to the top as being more successful than others. But at the same time, many people had used those same things in our research. And so it was also clear that it wasn't enough. But what the course does, so what we did was we basically created a protocol. And it took a while to do. But we took all of the lessons from that question on the intake form, and then we basically experimented around with it for a while and sort of refined the methods further and figured out, you know, how which ones work, which versions of which method work better than other things. So what we wound up with was a protocol that systematically helped people in an optimum way work through these things. What we wound up with was this complicated, initially 6 and then 12 and now currently 17-week protocol that has really had a sufficient degree of success. About 70% of people that use the protocol transition to fundamental well-being. And that's in the margin where you can spend money on that with, you know, EEG research and stuff like that and not be throwing so much away that you have failed projects. And so that's where the Finders course comes from, and that's where the name comes from. It's about finding your method. Ironically, people wound up transitioning in it. We thought, initially when I ran this, for the first cohort of 6 people, the pilot, I thought, you know, well, we'll follow these people for a couple of years, and maybe one of them will transition. And so it was really find the method that you can then practice for a while, and then, you know, hopefully you'll transition at some point, and then we'll be able to follow up with you and do B data collection to the A data collection that we did before it, and we'll get some knowledge about this. I did not expect the 5 people that successfully completed that protocol to all transition. So I didn't even have data acquisition set up for that eventuality or anything. And so fortunately, the name of the course works both ways because now people basically routinely become finders in it. But it was originally to find your method. It didn't mean that you were going to become a finder during the course.
It's quite a fascinating protocol that you've put together. So I so far have gone through, you've made reference to Headless Way. So in Headless Way, it's basically a variety of methodologies that get you to look at yourself and question your perception in different ways. We do general awareness. So in a general awareness exercise, what you're doing is you're actually experiencing awareness. This is in some ways different than the meditation traditions that I'm used to coming from, like It's a focused attention or compassion-based and very well versed in those. And here I was finding different methodologies that rather than focusing on the meditation side, which might be trying to manage your own physiology or changing your relationship to your thoughts, the methodologies you are offering are often changing your relationship to consciousness. So in general awareness, for example, you are looking around or you're, you know, experiencing what awareness is. And you spend literally hours sitting with yourself, stating the question, awareness is, and then seeing the next thing that arises. You know, awareness is spacious. Awareness is everything. Awareness is empty. And often these are very, you know, conflicting answers that you come up with to the point where you start to simply grasp the nature of awareness. The awareness is. I would no longer even say that I have awareness. Oh, awareness simply is.
And you probably noticed in the course, we front-loaded the awareness techniques, right? And so the group awareness exercise, which is what you're describing, that's, you do that solo, but you also do that in a group so that you hear everybody else's answers. And it's a, there's a safety mechanism with doing it in a group initially and stuff like that. And awareness is sort of front-loaded into this first part of the course because the majority of people transition from these awareness-based practices, like the group awareness exercise, headless way, unprovoked happiness. You know, these are all really direct. They're just designed to get your perception shifted in terms of your relationship to awareness itself. And that winds up being the thing that transitions over half of people.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And as I said, you know, very different than the meditation methodologies that I'm versed in and used to. The other thing I found very, very helpful was the love-based exercises. So there's a series of positive psychology exercises that we do every morning, every night. Then there's special exercises that you get, like do random acts of kindness, imagine memories of people from the past and profuse them with love. And the thing that I have taken away from there is a practice I now do basically every day. And that is before I do anything with anyone, I think about loving them. And so I might be, the first time I did this, the greatest transition I noticed is I got a message, an email from a colleague who did something a little bit frustrating and I was a little frustrated at it. Before I wrote the answer, I thought about how much I loved them. And all of a sudden my answer shifted. It was no longer like me being kind of snippy at them, like a little ticked. It was just this great sense of appreciation I had for everything that they did. This great appreciation for everything that was going on. Completely reframed it. And it was so powerful. I've just brought into, attempted to bring it into every aspect of my life. Being human, you of course forget. I've, you know, tried to draw little hearts in my hand, so I'm constantly remembering to do this. But it's also changed my relationship to people around me. And I was in the bank about 2 weeks ago, and I thought, well, why don't I just do the standing here at the bank? And I looked at the teller, and I looked at his face, and I looked at him with love, and I was just like so deeply appreciative of him. And like kind of thank God he didn't know what was going on, because he probably would have thought I was crazy or, you know, wanting to come on to him or something. But I just, like he was my son, I felt so loving towards him. And then there was an older woman who was not able to move as well, and she was sitting in a chair the back of the bank, and I looked at her and I just wanted to go over and sit down and like just start talking to her like I knew her and like she was a friend. And it's the kind of activity that then makes people think that you might be crazy, but what you're fundamentally feeling is this fundamental sense of openness and okay with and acceptance for everybody around you.
Those are so awesome to hear. You know, we don't often hear stories like that back here at Finders Course Central. So I'm so grateful when I hear things like that and hear the impact that it's really having just moment to moment in people's lives. We get the little snippets at the end of every week that summarize, you know, but they actually, those techniques actually form a composite. All those positive psychology exercises form a composite that was designed to mitigate the dark night of the soul type experiences from some of the heavier methods that come later in the course that you've yet to see. And an interesting side benefit of all of this is that when we went back and we analyzed the data years later, what we learned was that people were more likely to be successful in the course if they had higher well-being earlier in the course, either came in with higher well-being or got it earlier in the course. And so it's just sort of an accidental thing that we front-loaded with those exercises. And I think one thing that we indirectly sort of accidentally got from that was boosting people's well-being across the board sort of earlier in the course. And that has contributed, in fact, to the success rate of people transitioning. So it's really fascinating, you know, sort of watching all this come together.
It's fascinating experiencing it.
We keep calling it a course. So we should probably clarify that with people. Although we put this together initially as an experiment, we ran it as a course. And so from our standpoint on the back end, this looks like a really complicated protocol, right? But from your end, I hope it's very simple. It's just a bunch of simple things that you do every week and, you know, and it's in a class format and all of that. It wasn't until we made it into a class and we made it into something that people paid for that they actually took it serious and valued it and then, you know, went through it. And then we started to see the impact from it. And so initially it was just a research protocol, but we had difficulty getting research subjects, even when they were students and they were getting credit for it. Because if you think about it, it's about the length of a semester.
It's definitely a serious commitment.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah, that's very funny.
Consideration.
Well, going into it, I'm like, can I spend the next 4 months attaining fundamental well-being, doing this for at least an hour a day every day? It's like, of course. Is there a better investment of my time? And it takes a lot of time and a lot of commitment. And it's been, you know, challenging to keep all of the moving pieces together in my life otherwise. But the outcomes of it have proven to be totally worthwhile. It's one of those things that you front load the investment. I'm doing it when I'm 40, you know, wish I did it earlier. Okay, yeah. I'm 39. So I did it before I'm 40.
Absolutely.
Let's shift to talking about the neuroscience of this. So what is the neuroscience of a less than happy, less than settled individual, and how through going through these fundamental shifts, what is changing in the brain? What's changing the nervous system?
Absolutely. So I'm a big fan of giving credit where credit is due, you know, always. And to my mind, the key finding in this whole space was initially noticed by a research scientist associated with NYU named Zoran Josipovic. I don't know if you know him or not. And so what he discovered is that there's two big networks, and there's many networks in the brain, but there's a couple of the big networks. There are more than two. But there's one that, so around the early 2000s, someone at a university in St. Louis basically wondered what would happen if they looked at all of the fMRI scans for people while they were just laying around waiting for the experiment to begin. There was all this giant pool of data, right? And out of that fell something called, colloquially, the default network, the default mode network, right? And so I'm sure you must deal with the default mode network, you know, within Muse. And so what the default mode network, it does a lot of things, but one of the things it does is it relates to your sense of self. And so if you're just sort of laying in an fMRI machine, daydreaming or whatever else, you know, just sort of being you and not doing any tasks or anything, it lights up. And when I say a network in the brain, I'm just talking about different areas in the brain that sort of light up or sometimes the opposite at the same time. So they're clearly sort of wired together and they're working together and they're communicating in some way. And then they're doing something important and they're forming some sort of composite part of our subjective and really also our unconscious parts of our reality. And so this default mode network relates a lot to your normal, traditional sort of sense of self. It's up and active when that's more active. So if I give you a bunch of adjectives, and some of those adjectives are personal adjectives, and other adjectives are not personal adjectives, the default mode network will light up during the personal adjectives and not light up as much during the non-personal adjectives. It's a great, simple way to test that. Then the other network that's involved in this research is the task network, which is when you're paying attention to this podcast, you know, they're really doing a task. And so the task network goes up and sort of lights up at that moment. And so these are sort of contra networks to each other, right? So when the task network lights up, the default network falls more silent. And when the default network is lit up, the task network has fallen more silent. And what Zoran noticed was that there was a reduction in this anti-correlation between the task and default networks in people who were experiencing fundamental well-being. And that's a huge, huge finding in neuroscience because, you know, we don't know of other things that really produce a reduction. That seems like core brain function that just should work that way. You know, that like one should be up when the other's down, and the other should be up when the other, you know, it's just like that's how things should work. But it turns out that it doesn't have to be that way. And in subsequent analysis of those findings, what he learned was that what produces that at the end of the day is a rewiring between those two networks. And in that rewiring, if you really understand your neuroscience regions of the brain type stuff, the way that rewiring happens, you can really, really see how someone is describing fundamental well-being emerging from that rewiring pattern. Because there's a very clear rewiring that's happening in the brain. That rewiring wasn't there before. You weren't just like taking, you know, you weren't making like, oh, if this part and this part of the brain falls quiet, then there's this other part of this network connections that were always there the whole time that just come to life. No, these are new connections that are happening. And it's actually something quite precious that you better take care of, because it can just easily rewire itself back to the way it was before. That's actually your other fundamental way of being in the world, right? That was your default state of being in the world for most of your life. Most of your network connections in your brain, they're still wired for that, right? They can absolutely reopen the door to experiencing things like that, you know, if you want to again.
So this brings up a maybe touchy subject with a lot of people, which is, you know, you've got the sensation that you are one with the universe, and this is this, you know, spiritual place that you've attained. And what we're looking at is a rewiring between two networks in the brain.
Yeah, I can make a case for that being pretty much just what these regions in the brain do. If you understand, you know, here's one that relates to your spatial relationship with the world and, you know, blah, 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 right? I can make a convincing neuroscience story out of this. But we also have to accept that, you know, we ultimately have no idea why anything exists in the first place. You know, it's all a mystery how any existence even is, right? And we have no idea what consciousness is in the brain. We have, you know, the field of consciousness studies is virtually non-existent. Even though there's all kinds of people working on it, we're nowhere. And so, you know, we're pretty good with subjective experience. You know, we know if we shock this part of the brain, certain things will happen and stuff like that. But in terms of where it all really comes from and whatnot, it's an open question at this point.
Well, thank you very much for taking us to a journey inside the head of somebody who's transitioned. We didn't even talk about your transition. Have you transitioned to fundamental well-being?
Yes, I did.
Which locations have you visited?
I've visited quite a few. And I'm what you would call fluid. So like if someone goes to like location 4, but they decide to go back to earlier locations, we would call them a fluid 4 as an example. Some people, you know, they get to location 4, they want to go further. Some people, they get to location 4, they want to stick there. Some people get to location 4, maybe they want a variety of experiences. And so I'm fluid, but I usually keep myself around location 2, late location 2, because that's a very, very effective place for what I need to do in the world. On holidays, I like to visit location 3 just because it's such an amazing way of experiencing the world. I don't have to be as productive.
Amazing. Well, if you are curious about how you might achieve a sense of fundamental well-being and be able to jump from location vacation to location, you can check out the Finders course, and you can check out Dr. Jeffrey Martin's work at, Jeff, tell us where we can find you.
Finderscourse.com is where the Finders course is. Nonsymbolic.org is where the research is. DrJeffreyMartin.com is my personal site. But if you Google me, like, you know, I'm all over. It's easy to find the stuff on us.
Awesome. This was completely fascinating. Thank you for letting us inside your head.
Oh, this was really great. So often we deal with each other in the transformative technology space because the Muse is like such a foundational technology in creating that whole ecosystem. So this was a really nice time to be able to just chat with you about this other stuff.
It's great. I'm so glad I got to experience what you've been building.
Me too. And vice versa. You know, we use the Muse. I mean, as you know, we've used the Muse in the research. Arno DeLorme just sent me back the findings. Is the first cut of the findings from that big project we did with the Muse, and they're fascinating. Yeah. I mean, we're going to see so much. Anyway, thank you for enabling that.
My sincere pleasure.
Interesting subject. If you want to find out more about Dr. Jeffrey Martin's work, you can find him at drjeffreymartin.com, drjeffreymartin.com.
If you want to hear the full conversation, we went on for an hour and a half talking about the ins and outs of fundamental well-being, who he met along the way, and what his protocol is. You can find that at my website, arielgarten.com, arielgarten.com, for the full conversation, video, and show notes. If you're curious about Muse, you can find out more at choosemuse.com. And you can grab one with the Untangle discount code, untangle15. Have an amazing week. Keep all your neurons sparkling, and may well-being be with you.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top-quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full-price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.